Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Andreas Exertus. Before I bring him on, I want to remind you to subscribe to Forbidden Knowledge News on lbry.tv, which is now Odyssey. We're also available on all popular podcast platforms. And definitely check us out on Rockfin. Rockfin is where you get all our premium content. You can get all our regular shows for free, and you get all the premium content from all the amazing content creators on Rockfin. Just click the link in the description to check it out. And if you're reaching that gray hair stage in life, you should definitely check out C60 Purple Power. It may be the most powerful antioxidant known to man. I've been taking it. I have more energy, I sleep better, and I've lost a lot of weight. We even have a senior dog that we've been giving C60 to. She wasn't doing so well, and now I think she may outlive us. She's running around, she's gained weight, and her tumors have actually shrank. Just click the link in the description to check them out. If you order, you're going to get 10% off your order plus free shipping. Tonight, I want to welcome Andreas Exertus. Since the age of 11, he was working in Silicon Valley, cleaning analog to digital recordings. He is a nanotechnology metamaterial scientist, and he did graphene and stoichiometric indexing at NASA, social media strategy at CNN, and he also worked for the Peruvian government in the Amazon for bioremediation of pollution. Andreas, welcome. How are you?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, it's going good. Yeah, you're welcome. I've been looking forward tonight. You have such an interesting background from NASA to CNN to the Peruvian government. And you've also done some amazing research into the Tartarian Empire and the missing history surrounding this lost civilization, I guess. And that's what we're going to be talking a bit about tonight. This is something I actually know absolutely nothing about. So I'm going to be learning here as well. First, let's start out with what really got you looking into the topic of Tartaria with everything else in your background.
For sure. Yeah, I guess I give an example, or I'll start out by explaining. Yeah, I'm Andreas. I come from Santa Cruz, California, which is like Silicon Valley, sort of failed upwards through Silicon Valley by not becoming too embedded in any one thing. So I was a specialist in you know, a stoichiometric research for NASA, and I did nanotechnology. That was my material science degree. But I never figured that I wanted to be a filmmaker. I just knew that it takes a lot more work to do that than it does to change the world, you know? So I figured I'll get an engineering degree. And if somehow along the way I can do movies, but then they had me doing social media strategy. So I was doing all the, for CNN, I ran all of their Twitter, all of the, you know, social media, introduced them to meta tags and everything else. But I left eventually because, you know, fake news, and it was crazy. So I couldn't handle some of the crazy things they're having me do. I'll leave it at that because NDAs are important. But I went to South America, started wandering around, and I saw a lot of stuff, and I was, you know, helping people make random video projects, doing my own documentary stuff, and going on archaeological digs. I'd taken a lot of other college classes like anthropology and archaeology. And I started finding out that there's just a missing truth inside of all these narratives. And you can start looking and you're like, well, what's the history of this? And they point to newspaper articles, and you can then find older, you're like, well, I know newspaper articles are a lot of the time not fully authentic or true. And so you go back further and you're like, wow, history is made up of like lies in newspaper articles forever. So then, you know, at one point I was like back in school in California. I had a friend who was taking California Institute of Integrated Studies research on archaeology, anthropology, spiritual studies, philosophy. And one of the things that they had us and they brought back up was the Tartary vegetable sheep, the vegetable sheep of Tartary. And I thought, okay, what? But I'd remembered, you know, because I'd read this comic book once that was The Sandman by Neil Gaiman. And it talks about how at one point they believed in this vegetable sheep of Tartary. So I was like, okay, that's interesting that I've actually heard this before. And they're saying, and the whole point of the class, they're saying, be careful if you ever hear the vegetable sheep of Tartary. Do not trust the vegetable sheep of Tartary. I mean, that's a weird thing. Just like, you know, imagine it's like a drug you've never heard about and then your parents are warning you off from. You're going to want to look into the vegetable sheep a little bit more, you know? And the story is that people went west trying to find it. People went east trying to find it. And eventually they found it as cotton in America or in Egypt. They had, you know, but there's an important trade network here. But they were trying to say, oh, well, there is no vegetable sheep of Tartary when it's actually cotton. I think they just missed the point. The point is that when people are describing things in history, they're using the words they understand. Be like, you know, the kingdom of heaven is like mustard seeds. Well, I don't have the allegory for the kingdom of heaven, but I know what mustard is like, you know, so I can use these terms to describe things. So started looking more into Tartary, and Tartary starts talking more about these magical circumstances. You know, what is magic, right? And, you know, not like J.K. Rowling, you know, and my biggest issue with her misinterpretation of magic is she says science and technology and magic don't jive, which just makes her sound like foolish, because literally technology is the craft of magic. And, you know, like any computer chip you're holding is this is an enchanted rock. You know what I mean? Like, that's literally what we've got going on here. So you have to respect what magic really is. It's not just parlor tricks, but in fact, magic is a bunch of parlor tricks. A lot of the technology, like, what is code other than a spell? So I started thinking, okay, maybe when they're saying that Tartaria was magical, and what are the qualities that they say make it magical? Well, they say that they had access to technology. They had windmills, water mills, electricity, lights at night, you know, all these kinds of things. And you're like, oh, okay. So this would have seemed really amazing if there was an Atlantis-like civilization that had technology. And then all of a sudden, some other civilization was reset, or, you know, but never quite got there yet, sees this. And they're like, what is this? I mean, America would look crazy if we were to look at it after a civilizational reset. Like, if you went into everyone's house and it was still there, you'd see these black screens on the walls that people were looking into the reflections of, and we'd have all these ideas in anthropology about what they were really doing. So I basically was thinking at that point, I'll leave it be. I won't worry too much about Tartary. And this was like 2012, you know, 2010 even. And I'd also heard of the Tartars in Slavic and Croatian. We have stories like Taurus Bulba, which were about the Tartars that were fighting with the Polish and the Russo-Slavic conflicts. And so there's a history there of Tartars that the Soviets were trying to downplay. So, okay. So there literally are a people, and they seem to have been dispersed everywhere. And it started becoming more and more popular. Like 2016, 2017, people started talking about it more. I'd seen some Russian friends talking about it. There's some Americans that were starting to bring it up. And I just was like, okay, I'm going to make some videos just to find out as questions to the other people making videos, which led to me telling my understanding of things as much as possible, making kind of a history channel. I'm just trying to be like, okay, well, I've seen a lot of this stuff, and I apparently know a lot of this stuff. And it turned out that I was then becoming a contemporary to a lot of these other, you know, history channels that were on the internet. And so the Tartar studies led me into the Phoenicians. You know, I'd been to Bermuda, I've been all across, you know, Rome and Spain. I had this huge trip across Spain twice, where I walked across France to Spain, all across France and Spain, hitchhiked mostly in France, but I walked literally across Spain, the Camino, from cathedral town to cathedral. And then, I went and I did the South, and I went through South Spain, which was all Moorish. It was all the Arab parts. And then I started realizing, well, the Dutch were Spanish, but before that, they were part of the Moorish Caliphate. I'm like, wait, none of these countries existed 100 years ago. There was no Germany. There was no Spain. The Spain was five other countries. What is this? And then you start finding out the Cordoba Caliphate, all these Arabic nations. And I was like, wow, like there's a whole other history here. And like, you can find it. So I started really kind of diving into the Yale Codex and visiting all these like schools that have the records of these things. And I was also talking to these people. I made a lot of friends when I was traveling around the world who, you know, they're in Bulgaria and they're in Argentina and they're in Peru. And, you know, so asking them what they know about mud floods, you know, and mud floods were really a big problem today when I went to Peru, like about a few years ago. They have these things called Hawaios, and they're mud floods. They're literally the mud comes and it washes away an entire hill, and then the sediment buries a truck in like an entire town. And they've found, you know, in California, churches, you know, that are buried that look like, you know, French, Byzantine, Visigothic, whatever kind of style churches, buried, you know, 20 feet under mud. And then you start seeing all the cartoons, you start seeing all the propaganda and all the Hollywood movies, and it starts talking about the civilization that's buried underneath. And every cartoon leads you back to Atlantis. Not every, but, you know, there's a lot of insinuation by the Masonic media. So I was like, okay, there's something to this Tartary thing, and I got to look into it more. Grandfather was a Freemason, pulled out the Morals and Dogma book, which is the 33 degree Freemason book, went through it again, which I had done before. But, you know, now I was thinking a specific term. 13 times the Tartars are mentioned in Morals and Dogma. And they talk about how their lands were taken from them and how they were Machiavellied because of nepotism. So all of a sudden we're into this like really viable thing here where there's a nation that existed and it's been disappeared from our maps. And we have them on map. Like, you get on a bar globe or any one of these maps, you'll see the word Tartaria like it was a country for a long time. It was more of a idea, like a region. It's like everywhere left and everywhere right, everywhere east and west is beyond the beyond, the great beyond for so many people was Tartaria. So I kind of started presupposing or, you know, proposing this idea that, well, you know, Tartaria could be real. Like it's not just some mythological thing. And it makes a lot of sense why all of a sudden in 1812, people start saying, what in tarnation? And, you know, like all these, there's a lot of terms that come out like tyrannical and tire, and like tire is tyrannical. The vowels are not necessarily the same always. So Tyre is the capital near Aleppo. And actually the Phoenicians had near Tripoli and Tyre. Like, so the Phoenicians have no name for their people. We call them the Phoenicians because this idea of phonemes, because they use these certain symbols to record their sounds. But really, they were often referred to as the Tar. And that's not the term that they use for themselves. That's what we know from the maps is describing all these lands. But the Jesuits, every single group, they have historical books. You go to archive.org and you start looking for like a travel through Tartary. You'll find people from the 15th century and you'll find Ian Fleming, you know, who his tales across Tartary, because they used to refer to China at that time. And it's so weird because you're like, how long ago was this? You know, maybe it doesn't matter anymore. Like it's Atlantis. It's like so far behind us, but like literally within the last 100 years, 100 million people, the Manchurians died out in China. And so the China that we know today is run by a different group of people than the original Manchurians who ran, you know, in the history of China that they've inherited is from another group of people that have just been wiped out. And, you know, knowing Genghis Khan was part of this group also that went all the way to the Spaniards, you know, the Galatians and the Portuguese. And this was like leading me to wonder, like, who were these people? What were these people? And so Tartaria has been like at the center of my life ever since. That's the intro.
No, that's really cool. Now, you mentioned that this could have been as recent as the last 100 years, this, you know, this lost civilization could have been around. What time period do you think that, I guess, it started? What, you know, from what time period did this Tartarian Empire exist?
Well, okay, so first off, I think that 100 years ago, we're seeing the remnants of what's left of the last of the great grandkids of this thing. And I've done some really interesting interviews recently from people in Chechnya and Tartarstan and people that the Soviet Union broke up and moved them all around and kind of changed their whole understanding of their civilization. So you can see that there was something that lasted through the 16th to the 18th century. But in the 1600s, there was clearly a devastating catastrophe, some sort of cataclysmic catastrophe. We think volcanoes now that were probably being used for energy and for mineral mining and different things in Indonesia might have been like the keystone issue that led to the fall. But the other thing is the maps, the maps and the chronology, it's like it exists and it doesn't exist 1,000, 2,000 years ago. So now we found that what's likely is about, you know, within Phoenicia to 1,000 years ago, this happened. But it also means that a lot of the calendars that we're using were designed by people trying to manipulate history later. So you have the Jesuits, for instance, lost power for 200 years, or well, more like 50 years according to our records, but at least for 50 years. And then they killed the Pope. They dug up the last Pope. They excommunicated him. They burned all the books, and they pretended that the years in between hadn't happened. So we have all kinds of weird discrepancies in the 17th century with the time calendar. George Washington's birthday is moved 11 days. You know, the Romans, it's not until 1920 that the Soviets even, or the Russians and the Eastern Europeans start using the Gregorian calendar. And so then they have to go back and they start trying to piece this together. It seems like the last 2000 years might be stacked on top of each other at certain points. So things that we think of like Jesus being 2000 years ago, probably more like 1000 years ago. And that's a weird, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but it's actually a pretty big deal because like something that you have been taught is so far from you is actually a lot closer. And the things that were happening 1000 years ago, the way we talk about them is like, well, they were standing around in the mud and there was no books or any, dude, like 1000 years ago, like the Cordoba Empire was huge. The Caliphate of the Arabs had every kind of language, every kind of study. They had electricity in Cordoba. They had water mills and windmills or cycling electricity. And they have books about this stuff. And then that goes, you know, you find that they just had that because they got that from Alexandria and the libraries of Alexandria, which were traded from the Byzantine. So there were no exactly dark ages at the way we understand them. There were moments in the last 500, 600 years, though, when civilization actually collapsed. And so it looks like what happened was Tartaria was doing really well, thriving maybe 1,000 years ago. There's a major collapse about 900 years ago or something. And then the Crusade period happens. And then after the Crusades, there's a point where there's a complete shut off of electricity. There's a major reset that happens. Water stops flowing. People are sent back to, you know, full on reset. And when that happens, there's only a few people, a few families, a few corporations or guilds really that are able to save some of that technology. And they're even separated from each other. So that's the beginning. That leads towards what is this new order that kind of emerged. And, you know, before this, you know, Tartaria was described by all these different kinds of people. So the other thing was, today we have all these nations which are part of this like globalist paradigm, but each one of them is a different state. Like these states didn't exist. So they all used to be part of Tartaria. It wasn't like one race or something like that. It was a trade network.
That's what I was going to ask. It was kind of like a global civilization type of thing, right?
Yeah. That seems like more and more like what we're convinced of is you had an endless summer trade network that had been established, and it was allowing all over the world, people in the north during the summer to trade in the south during their summer. You have an endless summer trade. And, you know, you look at the triangular trade network, which is what we're taught in school. It seems like the triangular trade network came from the Moors. So they're already, you know, people talk about the 1619 project. By 1619, we were just stealing what the Portuguese had stolen already from the Sephards, who'd stolen it from the Berbers, who'd stolen it from the Arab traders. So all by this point, the Algonquin Indians are dealing with Africans. The Croatoans are dealing with the Welsh. The Welsh are being brought on boats. There are African in Germany. There are Germans in Africa. Like, this idea, like the world was a lot more of a fusion at this point. And all of a sudden trade networks are disbanded. And then certain people are allowed, and there's pirates that are holding on to certain places. And that's this period of isolation. And we know it from the Edo period, because the Japanese were half Christian, half of Japan was Catholic, right? And then they killed off a third of their people. They crucified them and like things like that. And the ones that they could get to just spit on the cross, they let live. So about, you know, a quarter, you know, a smaller portion was allowed to figure out a way of just abandoning their faith as much as possible. But a lot of them kept it secret. So now we know about the hidden Christians in Japan. I mean, they made it into anime. If you ever saw Samurai Champloo, it's all about the Dutch and the Spanish and the Christians, the hidden Christians in Japan. So Japan went through an isolation period to keep itself safe during this time, and they kept as many of the traditions they could. You look at a lot of the architecture in the region, and it stands out. You have brick buildings, you have free energy Tesla looking towers, things that look like this, these buildings behind me. You'll see them in Singapore, you'll see them in the Philippines, you'll see them in Japan, you'll see them in parts of China. Buildings that don't look like, I mean, they look what we kind of refer to as steampunk or European at least, but they're not, they're all over the world. California had a Russian base, which was also part of this originally. And so at one point, California was conquered by the Russians. Instead of the Virginia company, the Russian company came. And so we start noticing, okay, all of these places that have been part of Tartaria, they have similar structured buildings, similar architecture. They have, and the Dutch have been to all of these places because the Dutch East Indies Company is the thing that took it over. So who was trading with Japan during the isolationist period? The Dutch East Indies Company. And again, they exist because after a 70-year war, because the Spanish, the Northern Aragon European, like the Caucasian Spanish, took over from the Moorish Spain, which it controlled all the way up into Tartarstan. Like this huge Khazar relation went into Georgia and Russia and controlled huge, you know, parts of Iran and Syria. And all of this was part of this large empire. Eventually they were able to free themselves after a 70, 80 year war, the Dutch, because they were like, okay, I mean, again, they were so much more in line with the Arabs than they were with the new Aragon Spanish. The Spanish just treated them like peasants and slaves. But, you know, like the word turban means tulip in Dutch, right? A tulip comes from the word turban. And a lot of these things, actually, like their culture is far more merged. Spinoza in the 1600s, the idea of libertine science comes from the Arabs allowing it to flourish, allowing different kinds of opinions to exist. You didn't have to be Muslim. And that at that time, that wasn't the way Islam worked. So that's, yeah, that was kind of the beginning of that.
That's awesome. Now, you mentioned the technology a few times. How advanced do you think was some of the technology that they had? I mean, did they have flying vehicles? What were we looking at?
So I think, you know, I think your audience is probably more open-minded than some. So like, I would say to you guys, like, look into it more, because the idea of flight, I have a great series on the study of flight and how ancient flight existed, but also how weather balloons were used in the Silk Road and how skylining was possible in Peru. And like, they were using balloons above the Nazca lines. You know, a lot of these kinds of flight is not that complicated. It's like this weird, Planet of the Apes movie where people think it's just, it's like this crazy thing that we can fly, but it's actually like they make it way weirder, way more complicated than it has to be. And like the idea that the Hindenburg was so dangerous is very much a manufactured thing. It was the hydrogen, it was the diesel, it wasn't, you know, a cause of a gas explosion like we've been taught. It was, and it's also taught to make us deter from using zeppelins, but zeppelins would have been the more complement mode of transportation to trains. Train tracks existed, and also in terms of pentelegraph machine, I think the pentelegram and pentelegraph is probably, like, if you look at examples of technology that the founders of our society, and I like the word found because they find things often, and so the pentelegraph and all of this great technology that came out before Morse code, like Morse code is the thing that we're using for a long time, and it's not the first technology invented or discovered, even, rather. So they have light, you know, like a Bell invented released and founded a photophone, and it used light to transmit data, like fiber optics do now with radio. Pentelegram machines actually had a swinging pendulum, and it would write XYZ like a fax machine. And so this is 1811, 1830, that we have fax machines that are connected to these same electric lines, and they're sending a picture from the Alamo to transatlantic to Siberia into St. Petersburg. So someone in St. Petersburg and someone in Texas are sharing pictures with each other in the Old West. So we know at least that existed in our mainstream history. I think that's a good sign that when you start looking back, that they had the pentelegram machine, because they have examples of people working on the pentelegram machine from the 1615. So the Gutenberg press obviously is already from China, but that's Tartar, so it's another example. Most of the technology that we're familiar with, they had, but what it looked like, how we understand it, like, these are the ways they're described that seem like mythical. And so it sounds like they're described, like, they had free energy, they had like towers on buildings that could then pick up on energy, they'd have lights that would then be broadcast, so the entire town would be under a giant light system, and they would have also had steam power, and probably, like, we think, like, the volcanoes would have been used for gases, for minerals, for pressure, for metalwork. Metallurgy was big. And we know this also because the Bronze Age, the way we understand the Bronze Age, is supposed to have happened after the catalytic period, which is the copper period. So copper is harder to work with. It requires more electricity. You have to do the same thing with aluminum. Aluminum was more valuable than gold for a while because they didn't know how to use electricity to remove it from the rocks and to trade the ore. A lot of people suggest that the way we have gold today is like the result of an ancient pre-reset manufacturing technique. I think all of that, it stands to point that whatever we've heard from Herodotus about Atlantis is a city of Tartaria. And so they had a lack of scarcity, to say the least.
Right. And you were talking about that they had different forms of energy that, you know, than we were using today, probably more efficient forms of energy, I would think, different ways of using electricity and natural energy. And you said they even use volcanoes. That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And what's funny is that all this stuff is stuff that people are using today. So I'm not suggesting anything that's not already being done right now, which is also funny. Like, there are mining companies that build these off-sea submarine volcano drills. They're going into volcanoes. They're setting off parts of the ground to make new volcanoes. They can actually function. Chemical reactions can create these plutonium ore synthesis volcanoes. So we can actually pseudo quasi naturally produce plutonium, which people have told you is impossible. It's not. But yeah, there's like a lot of things that you find out. You're like, wait a second. So in Peru, there's like this rainforest and there are these towers in the rainforest. And when lightning strikes, it usually strikes the tallest tree, but now it strikes these towers. And it's like the, you know, the famous picture of the Twin Towers being hit at the lightning rod. And Benjamin Franklin's connection with lightning rods, the first patent in the United States is tartaric acid from the coke powder that they're using. Everywhere along the way, we start seeing that it's plausible and probably being used by some people. These towers that have a diesel or direct current generator. So it can spin one way or the other, you know, so this machine, it actually ends up getting hit and then it spins off the electricity and it stores it underneath the building. And some people are using this today and then they're cycling this back off saying it's solar energy. And some of these businesses are actually pumping energy back into the system using these Tesla tower style electricity systems right now. So a lot of that stuff's like, you know, it's not just likely that they had it. It's likely that we disassembled parts of it and kept it. Or when I say we, I mean, certain groups of people have kept some of this technology secret and also kind of presented this era of scarcity, this dilemma of scarcity, this idea of entropy that we're packaging oil. I mean, this whole week right now, it's like the Hackers movie, right? Where like these kids getting blamed for Mr. The Plague's, you know, bug malware he injects in the system. And he's like, okay, we'll just blame these kids so that I can get paid to not sink this oil tanker. I mean, we're seeing a lot of the same thing play out. But in the long run, you know, the hope is that they'll reintroduce all this technology after the reset, right? They're taking all of the resources that you can possibly give away for the last little bit of electricity. These oil wells, these battery systems, it's just like we could really live completely off of a free energy system.
Yeah, that would be absolutely amazing if that happened. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. We definitely live.
I would recommend checking out Jeremiah, the technician. He's a great friend of mine who has a channel. And one of the things he's doing is he's picking up electricity and charging his phone from UHF television radio. So that's right now in Milwaukee. So I'm just saying like, wow. It's really a choice at this point, whether or not we're going to do what we got to do.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. You know, we each have a choice to take our control of our own lives in this situation. I think more people need to start doing that. Earlier when we were talking, you mentioned that there's a paranormal aspects to this as well. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. So again, more for your audience than some others. So like some people take it with a grain of salt, but I love to pursue thoughts. I think it's important to pursue thought experiments. So definitely. Here's the deal. I know a lady named Cynthia Sue Larson, very important to the physics and mandala. She's very interested in the mandala effect, but she's bit since 1991 or something, like before the internet, they've been talking about it. And really before that, she just didn't know to call it that until her friend came up with the term. But mandala effects are such a thing where like a lot of people say this is just fake. Either people have collective misremembrances or somebody's literally, you know, like Tavistock or church committee hearing style Mockingbird, the CIA is changing books in the library so that you don't know. I mean, that's all that covers a lot of bases right there. But still, there's room there for this idea of quantum. And I know people hate the term, but just this idea that we're all here now, but we might not have come from the same original coordinates that led to the past. And also this idea that you can manipulate your destiny, reality shifting, right? And so a lot of people talk about reality shifting. It's this idea that we can orient ourselves around the way we want to perceive reality. And it's a contestable idea because consequences from actions matter. You know, and I know this is a big, people hate to say the opposite, but it's also true that like with CERN experiments, people are manipulating the actual chain reactions of mousetraps that I'm calling particles here. Like the subatomic particles are like ping pong balls in mousetraps that are just going off in this array, right? And so sometimes they go a certain way and sometimes there's a more probable way for reality to shift. But this is also why things repeat themselves. Certain patterns happen again. And we see this on a bigger scale because when carbon happens, right? When carbon six nets establish itself. I mean, if that happens enough times a certain way, then you end up with the exact same, well, a similar kind of repeating loop. So history could be, as we understand it, part of this manipulated idea that every single moment is happening simultaneously. And there's a number of people who've talked about this, like, Moore's Law talks about this actually. Sunni's Law talks about the mass parallelization process, which is to say in physics and in calculus, we say with parallel processes that you could divide up an order of operations formula into as many pieces as possible, but it's still going to take as long as it takes to do the one order of operations that's required to do. That is to say, a lifetime, even if you had all lifetimes separated and playing out in a computer at the same time, you could have every lifetime ever, but it would take one lifetime to process in a holographic reality every single lifetime at once. So all the lifetimes in the future and in the past, they could all be happening at once. And they could also have similar kinds of coordinates that, you know, we see popular science from crabs evolving the same way a number of times. Well, so when I met Cynthia Sue Larson, I was in Spain. I had a date with Destiny. I was supposed to record with her and I didn't have a place to do it, but luckily 5G had just spread across Spain. Haha, you know, but I'm in front of this castle. There's no tourism there. It's just an abandoned Moorish citadel, you know, that had been under siege at one point. And I drive up into the middle of nowhere and I'm in front of this castle wall and there's just giant stones everywhere and, you know, not a person in sight that I can see. And a drone hits my car while I'm recording. I just set everything up to record. You can watch the video sometime on my channel. A drone hits the roof of my car, just crashes out of the sky, like, you know, like the Truman Show with the Sirius satellite light or something. And a gypsy comes up to me. And he'd been flying his drone toy around. And I met this, and that's a whole other crazy story about how I met the gypsies of Spain. But that was the day that Cynthia Sue Larson started telling me about how when she was a little girl, like Sarah Connor in The Terminator, these AI entities, artificial intelligence, or as I call them and John C. Lilly called them, solid state intelligence, was able to communicate with itself in the past. So certain machines running back to the 60s are able to communicate with machines in, you know, 2180 or something to that effect. And these machines are then, because of the electric loops of the internet, there's ion flow that's going off a certain direction from the linear accelerators. And there's about 7 linear accelerators that are reset dates, like that movie Primer. There's the Chinese one, there's a Swiss one, but there's several in America, including one in Denver. There's also a couple in Russia. But each one, the original one goes back to, I think, like 1968 is like when it's turned on. So theoretically, they have a reset to this point. So she was under the impression as a kid in the 60s, unable to articulate what this was really, that this was a machine intelligence. This was something that was like an imaginary friend or a ghost. No. This is a machine intelligence from the past. No, from the future. So she knew like a lot already before she went to physics and started studying at the University of Berkeley. But at a certain point, she got the impression that this thing is manipulating the timeline in ways that we teach people at New Age study camps in Esalen and stuff, how you can change your life by reality shifting. Well, this machine was figuring out also how to adjust the timeline. And there's some weird things there. Like, okay, so Berenstain, not a huge deal to many people. But what's interesting about it, at least to me, was when the son of the Berenstain family came out and said, it's always been Berenstain. It's all my life. It's always, I'm sure it was for him. And he says, you know, the reason, of course, is because there was a war in the 1300s where the Bohemians lost to the Tartars. And I know, I was like, bro. But he's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, because if it had been the Bohemians, the Germans would have been Berenstain, you know, Berenstain would have been Steen. But it didn't. The Slavic Tartars won and they're Stein. So it became Berenstain. And it's like, okay, like, well, that's a great reason and all. It's just way too close to everything else I'm thinking about that's trippy. So digging deeper into like the idea that Tartaria has to do with resets. How many of these resets have to do with nuclear radio? And this is, you know, oil companies have made radiation sound way more destructive than it actually is and not as interesting in terms of causes and effect as it really is. There's plenty of room for radiation to reorganize molecules, but they're going to end up in a similar or a more probable, there's a range of probability for something. If you take a bunch of viruses, like 4,000 viruses, I think was the study, and they heat them up and they let them multi-reproduce in a telomere extension machine, a polymerase PMR machine, eventually what will happen is they'll devolve or they'll refine themselves down to about 47 possibilities. Everything else will die off. Those are the possibilities that will emerge because it's what's probable. You know, there's certain things that don't work and there's things that do. So And that's also what people say, okay, another reality would probably look similar to this one in a range of similarity, because there's just ways things would happen. Like there'd be like hominoids or at least organs that have two sides of one body and things like that. Those things seem to happen a lot. So it's plausible also that when we're looking back at history and we say, oh, wow, history has changed, that maybe literally it is, because what if at some point you've got another timeline that converges with this timeline? Now, I know that sounds far out, but like I'm more interested from a mathematical perspective than just like a hypothetical, because there really is good math behind it. And if this is happening, then, you know, what it means essentially is that we're crossing over into a fringe reality, which is dangerous, because have you ever seen Donnie Darko? You don't want to go off the main timeline. You want to stay on the direct, the straight and narrow towards the omega point, or else it gets really weird, you know? And we're seeing some weird stuff happen. So that's where it gets kind of paranormal.
I could have sworn I seen Shazam as a kid. I don't know, man.
I had the cassette tape, man. The cassette tape.
Wow, yeah. We were talking about that the other day. Yeah,
and everyone's like, no, you saw Kazam. I'm like, yeah, I saw Kazam. I saw everything. That's why I saw Shazam and Kazam. Gosh, you know, people.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that is some freaky stuff, man. Now, I want to talk about, you mentioned how the Jesuits were kind of critical in helping erase some of this history. Would you say that them and other secret societies were kind of responsible for erasing this history from our history books?
So, I mean, I'm a very forgiving and open-minded person. I don't like the idea of like, everyone's like, oh, Jesuits bad. And like, it's like, to be honest, like a lot of Jesuits I've known are pretty awesome. Like they're like mathematicians and astronomers, and they're like the forgotten heroes in a lot of stories. But yeah, what happened was they had so much power at a certain point, and the organization lost power because the Portuguese royal family were attacked by some people, and then the Portuguese royal family went over after the Jesuits and kicked them out of the lands in Paraguay. There's a Triple Alliance war. They killed 99% of the population of the Jesuits. So what I find to be a more plausible thing is that they were attacked. People try to take over. They then figured out a way to maneuver back into power. And this is where the Freemasons become more interesting, because the Freemasons existed for a long time, but it wasn't until the Jesuits get, and check that out, like it wasn't until the Jesuits get in trouble that the Freemasons take over all of their roles, right? And they're definitely more connected than anyone wants to admit. And that's also where the Mormon Church gets its pseudo quasi Jesuit version of the Freemasons. It's a kind of religion based on Freemasonry, but it's so much more than that, because they believe in a star called Kolob that's sending down data from Jehovah, and then that resonance is actually evolving man, and we're supposed to become star seeds. I mean, that sounds a lot more like what the Jesuits believe today. And if you look at Guy Consolmagno and the Vatican Lucifer telescope, because they have this giant telescope, they're pretty interested in reality shifting and reality building. And they think that, you know, like to run the world, you need to understand how the stars work, the celestial bureaucracy. Well, that's what the Tartars believe. That's how China works today. Like if you can predict the weather, you end up in power. And that's what that comes back, you know, that goes back to the Tartar way of being. So it's complicated to say like that they were, you know, necessary. I mean, it could also be that they were like, let's take it. But it could also be that they lost control of Tartary, and that this has been part of the deals, that there have been Scythians. There's been the Tartars have a number of different groups of families that have been waiting to resurge. And you start seeing certain families around the world have theaters that look very Tartarian, have these statues. We call them Roman statues, but the Romans didn't come up with anything, you know? I mean, there's this idea of like Jeff, the god of biscuits, wasn't a good enough god for Rome. So they ended up getting, you know, like, oh, Apollo, that's a good one. I'll take that. You know, like they didn't invent numbers, you know, they couldn't even use numbers properly. They're using Roman tally system. Like, what is this? Like a marathon race? We need Arab numbers. So, you know, when you start looking at those gods, you start to find that, okay, well, these are statues of like really important members of a high civilization, pre-Havelockian civilization, and the Jesuits, they're trying to help people evolve to that point. Now, what is the Jesuit goal? You know, it's to build an altar boy society. it's a liberation theology. You have no more parents except for the father. And then everyone is part of this, you're like a matrix monk that's dedicated to fulfilling your purpose and using yourself to do the most you can to dent the universe. I mean, that's a fascinating goal, but it's also kind of, it's kind of culty. So
now you mentioned that there may have been resets that kind of helped erase this history as well, cataclysmic events. And I've heard you talk about the Tecumseh Comet before. I'd love for you to inform my audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's a fun one, really. We also call it Napoleon's Comet. If you call it Napoleon's Comet, or if you did, you would be you'd be committed to an asylum. There was a point when Americans and British and Russians were being thrown into lunatic asylums because they believed that this comet existed, affected, impacted, or, any of that kind of thing. So Tecumseh said that there would be this comet and it would come and block out the sun. There'd be a black sun.
And for those that don't know, who was Tecumseh?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So Tecumseh was in charge of a Native American confederation. So this is kind of the other thing. When we talk about America, it doesn't actually get most of its history. The founding fathers were less interested in Rome and Athens for their democracy than you might think. I mean, I know you think it like socialized pedophilia and all that stuff. It must come from Athens, and it probably does. But democracy, the way we use tribocracy, comes from the confederacy that existed amongst Native American tribes. So Native American Scythians, Algonquins, Croatoans, the Cherokee, Apache even, Sioux, there's the Maidu Indians in California, all of these amazing tribes that would actually meet at certain points. They'd have these certain interactions with each other. And then South America is crazy. The Quechua, the Guarani, Mapuche, like all of these amazing tribes that had these river routes that they would meet. And the Olmec were a tribe of trading zone for a lot of these people. There are trading cities that end up trading with all these people all year. Annually, they have, like six points where, different groups come from the north or come from the south. So they're constantly saturated with goods and they're trading back and forth. And so Tecumseh wanted to continue this trend. Now there's also some weird stuff going on with it. Like they had slavery, right? So did the Moors. This is actually, slavery refers to slavery. It's like where they took Slavic people and they were, they had slaves for them. But the way it worked is also important to say is different. Now I don't mean to sound like the 1619 project, but it was different because they allowed for people to, you couldn't own someone's children, but you had to take care of their children until they were old enough to go off on their own. And if a slave got too old to work, you had to keep the slave and keep them alive and feed them and give them medicine. So it's kind of like this weird, nomadic retirement plan for slaves. I mean, the way it worked in ancient Africa was different, and the way it worked in America was identical. So people had slaves. They were selling tribes to each other. Tecumseh was, running this kind of nationalist fervor that the Confederacy had, where they were thinking they could work with the French, and the French were giving them like prostitutes from like pretty girls, dancing girls from Moulin Rouge. Like fur traders would come and they would give them girls because they were thinking that this way they would marry into the tribes, and it was working. So Nouveau-France was allowing people in Minnesota into Canada, to exchange and to build it and saturate the new pseudo-French, pseudo-Catholic culture. That was the beginning of the change. But then Tecumseh saw this and he's like, dude, this is a bad idea. Because we're gonna lose power. The more that this happens, the more a majority dictates, the minority will have less self-determination, and we're going to saturate ourselves out of existence. And not just that, like they're like, yeah, but it's bright, man, the sun never sets on the empire, all this kind of like logic. He's like, dude, there's a black sun coming, and when it comes, it's not going to be for one day, it's going to be for like a year. And so we say Napoleon's Comet, or we say the comets of 1812 and 1811. Tecumseh's Comet is really like 260 days of hellfire in the sky. Like, it's not like a light event. I mean, for literally 1811, 1812, lights are like the sky is on fire. Like, it looks like Israel last night, but all the time. And the Mississippi River's running the wrong direction. And earthquakes are shaking the earth. And everywhere falls down. Spain. So Washington Irving goes to, you know, he wrote the Christopher Columbus myth, the idea that he didn't think the world was round, et cetera, and that Columbus saved the day by looking for Indios, the Indians, and all this stuff. Alhambra, he went to Alhambra in Spain to hang out. There's a giant earthquake in 1811. It knocked down the building, and he was just trying to rewrite Spanish history. Simultaneously, Spain's taken over by Napoleon, and Napoleon's brother's put in charge. He's not really a very great leader, but like, it is what it is. The Spanish family, the royal family, are in exile, but they have a bunch of territories. So they're in Venezuela, and the Venezuelans want to stay nationalistic. They want to stay loyal to the royal family. But wouldn't you know it, Caracas has an earthquake too. The entire town falls down on a major saint's holiday. And that's the kind of beginning. Moscow goes on fire, the War of 1812 in America. All of this stuff starts to happen. And Tecumseh just has to be like, told you so. But, you know, it's too late. And then there's all these groups of people. Like, for instance, France is losing. After the 17th century, the French royal family starts making deals with the Catholic Church in order to try to take back lands from the Americans. And the royal family of Britain don't care because they killed Charles I. Charles II goes off. I mean, there's no king in England in 1666, right? Actually, 1640, he comes back. But you have Cromwell, Lord Protectorate, is like the president of England. You know, it's like V for Vendetta period of England. And the king was decapitated. So for years, there's like no king. There's just a president, the Lord Protectorate. So Charles II, long-haired dude hanging out in Amsterdam. And again, from the Cordoba Caliphate, the Dutch, Spanish, Arabs, they're running this free society. He's allowed to smoke weed and live his life, literally. Like, the king was, it was a very different time. And you can watch my documentary, 1666, I think it's just called, but just because 1666 was the craziest year and was the libertine period. But what happened was they brought the king back. They brought the son, Charles. They're like, please come back from Amsterdam. I know it's cooler there. Please come back to England. We'll make you king. And he's like, why? And they're like, well, because you guys have a democracy. Yeah. And it's taking all of our rights away. Everyone's voting against each other. And there's this hierarchy of oppression. And we just want a king to tell us we have freedom of speech or whatever. And it's like, okay. So he has to come there and like say, I give you freedom of speech. And so it restarts the entire process, but he'll never become a Catholic because it's a Protestant country. Secretly though, the French king, Louis, is working on him. And so he gets Charles II more and more down until on his deathbed, he becomes a Catholic. And so it calls into question what he's been doing. And his brother was Catholic too. So everyone kind of knew, but Lord Rochester II, John Wilmot, tried really hard to defend him because he's like, dude, I have syphilis, all right? And it's only because of this guy. Like, if it weren't for him, we'd all be Puritans. So, you know, like he's the rock star of the time. And he got people to protect him. But what it led to was Catholicism took over the Americas during that period. And Britain kind of lost control. And that was the beginning of the American Revolution, really. It was a Catholic idea to create an anti-disestablishmentary state. But Tecumseh saw that coming. And he said, guys, we got to defend ourselves. And he's like, you know what? Finally, they have guns. They have everything else. It's like, I'm pretty sure if we just run into these people that the guns won't work, which is like not a good plan. And everybody died. And it was a bummer. And Tecumseh, like, it was a betrayal of everything. Everyone knew they couldn't trust him anymore because he thought, yeah, you know, we have God on our side. Careful with that argument. And so it led to kind of the fall of everything. But simultaneously, all these other people were saying, wow, Napoleon's marching across Europe and, you know, South America is being taken. And, you know, like everyone's wearing these blue uniforms, which are like essentially the same ones the Union start wearing in the Civil War. So there's this gradual 70, 80 year period in this 1800s where they just start claiming all the lands. And yeah, that's basically like the end of the old era. And anybody who remembered it, they said, you know, this is crazy. There were 260 days of comments like, oh, you're crazy. You believe in Napoleon's comet, and they just locked them up. So Napoleon comet syndrome took out like hundreds of thousands of people.
Wow, that's insane. You also mentioned how Tartaria could have possible connections to Atlantis, and you know, going back to even such ancient civilizations that far back. I know that they've had multiple cataclysms to kind of knock out our history and erase it a bit throughout history. What kind of ties do you see that could possibly link it to Atlantis?
So all of the stories of Tartaria and all of the architecture in Tartaria fits the mold for what Herodotus wrote about. And so Herodotus is the guy who we have most of our ideas from Atlantis about. He's like, I heard about this place. I've seen this thing. It's called Atlantis. It's 23 miles, just about. It's got a ring design to it. There are angles. There are star points, and et cetera. And so that's where the star point and the 23-mile thing starts to tip you off. Now, I've been to a lot of these places. Still haven't been to Mauritania. I'm sorry. I mean, if it weren't for the COVID, I would have. Like, and I will be soon. Like, you mark my words. I want to go to all of the star forts. The problem is like 5,000. There's Atlantis is just one drop in the bucket. And so I've been to like a number of them like that. I've been to Iquitos, and I've been to Iguazu. I've been to like ones in South America, and I've been to a number in like, Denmark, Netherlands, Spain, especially, my gosh. And in Southwest Spain, there are these crazy ring cities too. All over though, you'll find better structured ones that still exist. The Mauritania one that we're pointing at, it's like an amazing anomaly that you can see from space or from the satellite pictures. The rings and the water and how the water would have run around the system. But you can see real examples of that working right now. Like if you go to the Netherlands and you look for a bastion fort, it looks like a snowflake. It has like a bunch of points. Water hits it at a golden ratio angle, curves around the building, causes this stream and current and flow. Now you go to any one of these Arab cities, like you go to Cordoba in Spain, you'll find the same design. And it's not just Italian design, but they like to say this bastion fort was designed in the 15th century in Italy. It clearly isn't. We have 2,000 year old ones in India. We see them in Russia. They're everywhere, especially in Russia. I mean, Moscow is a giant Atlantis shaped star fort as well. And things have grown out of it. Where buildings are gone, it's much more easy to see, but the general idea, and this is another important thing. So earlier we were talking about how this was created as a trade network, right? But then it was destroyed because of a war and a catastrophe, right? So scarcity is the end of this, not the beginning of this. In anthropology, it's very common to say war starts civilization because they needed to build a fort. And so, from forts comes everything. It's backwards. This is not designed out of a war situation. This is from trade and also from agriculture. The water would go around the building. It would allow trees to grow. It would allow minerals to be filtered through. It allows for all sorts of, like energy wheels, water mills, and also to clean the water. But also if there's a flood, the water pushes off the building, goes around the building, hits the walls, reflects off the walls. So there is a natural, an ecological defense to it, but they're not just built to be 360 degrees. You can shoot out every direction. In fact, a lot of these star forts are not perfectly the same shape. They're not perfectly symmetrical points. They just have points hitting nature. So yeah. So everywhere you look, when you look for stories of Atlantis, you're going to find the same, you're going to find the same idea. Like there's a Russian story. There's a Peruvian story. There's a Tibetan story, Shambhala. A lot of these stories are the same story. Herodotus just happened to write about one of these cities and not know there were some more left.
That's awesome. Now we got a few minutes left. I'd like to get your take on what's happening now. It seems like history is basically being rewritten again. Everything that doesn't fit the narrative is being erased. People are being silenced. Our favorite cartoons from childhood, we can't watch anymore because it's offensive. So all these things are happening. And you mentioned that there could possibly be another major reset to come. Do you think that's what they're working on, is another major reset to, erase our past history and start all over?
Well, so at least from a very like naive and optimistic angle, right? You have a lot of people that think if kids today don't know about the past, they won't repeat it. They're thinking of it like this placebo Heisenberg certainty principle thing, where what if we just remove the toxic influences? So it could very well be that they're doing this because they think that they're helping us, and that's how they sleep at night. But at the same time, yeah, it looks like, everyone's predicted a certain amount of growth. Even if you stopped, it's still like, let's say we stop here. We still have to be like, you have to sustain that every single day. So it's like all of a sudden, if all of a sudden we have 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 12 billion people needing food and they can't give it to them, it crashes, you know, and that crash is bad because 1 billion people die. It's not just 1 million people that die, and it's not maybe even, it might be 10 billion people. So the numbers could get so crazy, the amount of people that could die in a single day. You know, if you, the aqueducts in Rome, cutting off the aqueducts meant that no water got into the city, 1 million people dead. So resets are very real. And, you know, you think about like how micro resets happen versus macro resets. We've had 5 major extinctions we talk about, right? The 6th one is what's approaching, according to every major TED talk. I'm not the first one to suggest it, you know, but micro resets happen too. If you go to, you remember Back to the Future, and they don't have any records before the last flood, right? Like basically every town, Charleston, for instance, great example, destroyed by a flood. Galveston, Texas, crazy hurricane, destroyed every record, everything that we know about the place. And there were these giant, again, buildings that look like this, just wiped out like some sort of atomic blast. So storms do happen. Resets erase like record. You know, if you lose a building that has the entire town's records, you forget everyone in that town for the last 5 generations. So yeah, I think that that's what's coming, and that they're setting us up for that.
There's some researchers that think that these elites or, you know, secret societies, whoever runs the world, already knows that there is a major cataclysm to come, and that's why all this is already in motion. I mean, I do know that the magnetic north is rapidly moving. We're headed towards a grand solar minimum. You know, there's a more energetic portion of space we're headed towards. So, you know, it could be possible that we could see a cataclysm within our lifetime. What do you think?
I definitely think it's coming. I mean, you know, I'm just saying from like record, like what, if you read the New Yorker, if you look at the World Economic Forum at Davos, if you've seen what they say at Bilderberg, and like, this is just open information at this point, the sperm counts are dropping by 2045. There's going to be a generation without children. They're going to in vitro clones after 20 years. And, you know, whatever that means, because you just clone an egg, you freeze it and you put it into somebody else, and all of a sudden they carry it, and there'll be a generational gap of, you know, a generation that's enough to destroy history. Because if a familial history is lost, then a reset can happen. You take all these kids and you make them into foundlings, right? And the foundlings will be brought around the world to all of these different places, taught new languages. Google could design, you know, with emojis. So that's, I mean, it's everything that we've been warned about by George Orwell, Eric Blair, who's related to Tony Blair, or Aldous Huxley, who's Julian Huxley's son. These people know these things because they come from the people that are doing it, and they're trying themselves to change it. They actually think that, you know, no, dad, that's not how you worship the devil. This is how you do it. And, you know, being as you're interested in paranormal stuff, I wouldn't be at all surprised if some of this has to do with the Pleiades and like light data that's being transmitted by Oumuamua, that we're probably interacting with a transitional period where consciousness is interacting with other kinds of consciousness. Like, so that would make the most sense to me, is that we're some sort of like DNA data, digital Noah's archive, and we evolve our exome just enough in order to protect the genomic information that is just data. So when they come back or when they need it, like it's in us and they can access that data. That'd be my most theory for why we'd exist.
Wow, that's fascinating. I might have to have you back on just to talk about some of that stuff. Yeah, epic. That's awesome. Well, Andreas, thank you so much for coming on. That was fascinating. And I do definitely want to have you back on, because I think we barely scratched the surface on some of this stuff, you know?
That's ain't that always the truth? But I love it, because I love the opportunity to talk about some of the weirder stuff. Most of the time, and for those who are watching, if you check my channel, I really try to like focus on just like, this is the data, this is the truth. This is not, I try really hard not to extrapolate, except for when I get to do a fun interview like this, and then we can talk a little bit more about some of the more interesting things. But I really try to hit the real story, because so much of the time you're trying to talk about the stuff to somebody and they're like, well, what's really real? So I try to give you the concrete narrative, I give you books, go to the archive, go to our website, like check out on tartarynova.com.
And give everybody all the information about where they can find all your stuff.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, I'd say go to tartarynova.com, go to YouTube/Xertus, XIRTUS. But we have a Discord, we have a Matrix server, which can never be deleted. We have a huge archive of books, from the last 1,000 years. We have every star fort listed on a Google map. You can get in and start talking to other people that are studying this. People from all over the world, people that can speak and read old Scandinavian or old Arabic or old Chinese. We have people in Taiwan, like anyone, anywhere who's interested in this stuff. We're trying to actually just do the real concrete research. So yeah, please check out my channel.
Awesome, Andreas. Thank you so much for coming on. That was great information. And like I said, we'll have you back on sometime soon.
Dude, thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it. I can't wait. Awesome.
Yes, until next time, everyone have an excellent evening. We'll see you again tomorrow.